If you're looking at your phone right now, you've found us on mobile, which means we can get a move on. You know me, you know what this is, so let's begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It could be the most important diplomatic achievement of the 21st century, a nuclear deal with Iran that might pave the way to normalized relations. It could be the worst act of appeasement since Neville Chamberlain said peace in our time back before World War II. Whatever your view, we are on the verge of something, and that's where we begin The Takeaway. Former ambassador to Germany Syed Hossein Mousavian was a high-level nuclear negotiator for Iran until 2005. He was also an accused spy by his own country, a man whose life has tracked the jumbled and confused politics of Tehran. Today he lives in Princeton, New Jersey, as a research scholar. Following the talks in Switzerland very closely and with a perspective like few others, he joins us from Princeton today. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thank you very much.
What's your assessment of these talks, of this last-ditch effort, it seems like? Is it now or never?
Definitely. They are extremely close to a final deal. They have never been such close. They have made unprecedented progress. It is already stated by two parties. And the good news is that they have already agreed on four principles. Iranians would accept to the maximum level of transparency based on international rules and regulations. And Iranians would be ready to commit to measures assuring no diversion on their nuclear program for a long period. And the U.S., the world powers, would gradually lift the sanctions. And also they would accept Iran having enrichment within its soil for peaceful purposes and for its practical needs. These four principles already agreed. Now they are trying to have a statement by maximum tomorrow about all major issues, going to more details, and then they would continue their talks in order to reach a comprehensive, detailed agreement by June, July 2015.
Ambassador Mousavian, let me get into those details. And I know you're more or less involved in the details, but I won't have you speak for Iran or the United States. I understand that you're an observer here. But is it your understanding that the lifting of the sanctions will be gradual enough for the West to assure that verification procedures are being followed? Is that basically what they've agreed to?
Actually, this is one of the disputed points. Even today, they are discussing whether this would be graduate enough for the world powers, for the U.S., or for the Iranians. This is practically one of the sticking points. Although, principally, they have agreed ultimately all sanctions would be lifted. But still they are negotiating about the duration of removal of sanctions, which is going to be in different steps.
So then let's move to the second principle. Is the issue of delay of diversion or ramp up, I don't know what sort of terminology they're using. I understand that there is a dispute over whether the technology will be permitted for the Iranians to move forward quickly on a 3 to 6 month period to develop some sort of weaponized uranium or a 4 to 6 month period. The West prefers the 4 to 6 month period. Where do they stand on that? The longer period or the shorter period to prevent an instant sort of escalation to a sort of nuclear capacity here?
The expression they use is breakout time.
Breakout time.
They have already agreed for 1 year breakout time.
Wow, that's a concession.
Yes. I think, this is my understanding, this 1 year breakout time would continue for about 10 years. However, some members of the P5 plus one, like France, they are insisting on longer period. But to my understanding, Iranians and Americans would be happy to compromise ultimately on a period of 10 years.
We're speaking with Ambassador Syed Hussein Mousavian, who was a high-level nuclear negotiator for Iran until 2005. So, Ambassador, the diversion and transshipment of already stockpiled enriched uranium, is it your understanding that Iran has agreed to some method of putting this somewhere where it is safe or out of the hands of Iranian scientists, which would include sending it to Russia, but that wouldn't necessarily be the only scenario? Is that your understanding?
I think two scenarios would have the best chance in order to give confidence to the world powers. Iran had already some 100 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium, which already after joint plan of action, Iran diluted and partly converted to the fuel pellets. Now, Iran has about 8,000 kilogram of enriched uranium below 5%, which the big part of it, to my understanding, would be either diluted or would be converted to fuel pellets in order to make sure that Iran does not have excessive enriched uranium for making nuclear bombs.
Is Iran permitted, according to your understanding, to develop new, more advanced centrifuges, or do they have to destroy or mothball existing centrifuges to keep their program in compliance?
Iran would be treated as a normal member of NPT after the duration to be agreed for confidence-building measures, which many measures would go beyond NPT. All limits we are discussing is for a period of confidence building. I believe the period would be something like about 10 years. After that, Iran would be a normal member of NPT. It means Iran would be treated like Germany, Japan, Brazil, and there would be not limits beyond non-proliferation treaty. However, Iran already has agreed with the P5 plus one about all measures within non-proliferation treaty, NPT. Here, there is no dispute. Iran has already accepted all commitments, obligations within NPT. The disputes left are about the measures beyond NPT.
Right, all right. And this is all within reach, you view.
I believe they have two no-return points. One, the Iranian enrichment program has already reached no-return point. Second, nuclear talks, specifically after Iranian election, June 2013, which the U.S. has been extremely active, the nuclear talks, I believe, have reached to a no-return point. Therefore, to my understanding, they are condemned to agree whether tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, it's going to come.
All right. What do you think is more valuable to Iran? Being in the nuclear club, even as a scientific sort of participant in the nuclear club, or having normalized relations with the United States? What's more valuable?
See, something Americans, perhaps 99% of Americans, they do not know is the fact that after Revolution 1979, Iran decided to cancel all ambitious nuclear projects laid down by the Shah and the United States of America. Because the U.S. denied the rights of Iran for having one nuclear power plant already built by Germans, paid to Germans, and because the U.S. denied the rights of Iran to have access to international fuel market for the only nuclear power plant, Iran was forced to go to enrichment. Otherwise, Iran decided not to have enrichment, not to have 20 power plants proposed by the U.S., But even the U.S. was not ready to accept one nuclear power plant. Therefore, from the day one of revolution, Iranian intention has not been to be in the nuclear club. Believe me, this has not been the case.
So it's more valuable for Iranians to have normal relations with the U.S. than it is to pursue a nuclear program.
I have been 8 years in National Security Council of Iran, responsible for foreign policy. The national security threat number one for Iran is the U.S. And you have heard a lot of times from the Americans, officials, that Iran is top national security threat for the U.S. Therefore, I believe for Washington and for Tehran, the priority is rapprochement in order to address their number one national security threat. Here, I believe Iranians are more for normalizing relation with the U.S. and with the West and go forward for mutual cooperation, fighting the real security threats today in the Middle East, which is ISIS, Sunni extremism, terrorism, and crisis in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Lebanon, and all over the Middle East.
Syed Hossein Mousavian, thank you so much for speaking with us here on The Takeaway.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
We will hear more from Ambassador Syed Hossein Mousavian. His unique perspective on the puzzling and frustrating relationship between the U.S. and Iran tomorrow on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Ken Ford is one of the few scientists left from the days of Edward Teller and Stanislaw Ulam, the men who developed the super bomb that essentially was the Cold War upgrade to the bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The thermonuclear H-bomb created the doctrine of mutual assured destruction, so unimaginably destructive that its use would equal defeat for the nation that used it and the world itself. Ken Ford's book, Building the H-Bomb, A Personal History, chronicles his younger days working on the H-bomb and the first test of the hydrogen bomb conducted on a Pacific island that was all but destroyed by a blast in 1952. In my considered opinion, he wrote, this book contains nothing whose dissemination could possibly harm the United States or help some other country seeking to design and build an H-bomb. The last thing Ford expected was that his story would produce a secrecy problem with his own government. This 88-year-old physics wizard has had to brush up on his legal definitions of top secret and Q clearances to keep the U.S. government from censoring his memoir, which is a part of American history.
That comes down to what they define as restricted data, capital R, capital D, restricted data. That's a categorization of weapons-related information. I think of it as a tablet up there in the sky on which is engraved all of this information about nuclear weapons, much of which, in the meantime, has in fact been released by such people with authoritative backgrounds. So what we have is really a catch-22 situation in which some of this data exists both simultaneously, both as secret information and as public information. And because I did have Q clearance and because I did have access to weapons information, I'm denied, according to the Department of Energy, I'm denied the opportunity to reveal any restricted data, even if others have authoritatively revealed it before me.
How frustrating has this been?
It's been quite frustrating. And the interesting thing is that I never imagined that I would even need to submit my manuscript to the Department of Energy for review. I had finished a manuscript by June of last year, 2014, and was all set to start dealing with the publisher and making small corrections to refine it. And an acquaintance of mine at the Department of Energy said to me, you know, Ken, you really ought to submit that review to the Department of Energy for a review. Well, it hadn't occurred to me that that would be necessary because I didn't think there was anything conceivably in it that could conceivably harm the United States. However, I acceded to his suggestion. I did submit it, and then it's been not a nightmare, but it's been a very difficult period of many months that have gone by since I submitted to them. Initially, in the expectation that it would take only 2 or 3 weeks for them to complete the review. Well, more than 6 months have passed, and they submitted to me in November a list of 60 different items in the book that I should remove. And it was made plain to me that these were not suggestions that I remove them. They were directives. I was required to remove them. Well, those 60 items added up to about the equivalent of about 20 pages of a 200-page book, about 10% of the book. And I was able to respond in detail to each of those 60, stating in at least 57 of the instances why I did not think it was appropriate or necessary to delete the material. So we've had a bit of back and forth on that. Finally, we reached an impasse in January of this year, and I just simply gave up and said, well, since I know and am absolutely sure in my own mind that there's nothing in here that could possibly harm the United States or help some rogue nation trying to build an H-bomb, I'm going to go ahead and publish, and I did.
What do you think is the easy fix here to just move on and get an important historical story told and to get the government off your back?
Well, I can think of three things that the Department of Energy could do that would achieve that end. One is they could simply declassify my book. They could say, okay, your book contains secrets, but we recognize that those are not secrets whose publication could possibly harm the United States, and therefore we are going to declassify your book. That's one possibility, and I've strongly recommended to them that they consider that. Another thing they could do is simply remove material in the restricted data category that doesn't belong there. Material that has entered the public domain and should have been erased from the restricted data category but has not yet been erased. Well, that's a second possibility. The third possibility for them, which would be leave me in a little bit of an uneasy state, is simply that they would do nothing. They could say, well, we didn't want that book published, but it is published. And if we go after Ken Ford, we recognize that the result is only will be that he'll sell more books. So it's possible that they'll just choose to do nothing.
Ken, you're a young 88, right?
That's correct.
Do you think that in your lifetime you will see an H-bomb used in a military operation for one reason or another, even by accident or intentionally? What do you think?
I think not. We've gone 70 years without using nuclear weapons, and thank God. The goal, certainly expressed by President Obama and no doubt held by leaders throughout the world, the goal is zero nuclear weapons in the world. That certainly won't happen in my lifetime. It probably won't happen in the lifetime of my children. But perhaps by the end of this century, it is certainly a goal worth pursuing. And I am optimistic that any nation that possesses nuclear weapons would realize it's very counterproductive to use them, that there's no real good reason to use them. And therefore that we might remain a world free of the use of nuclear weapons for a long time to come, and eventually even a world free of stored and available nuclear weapons.
Ken Ford, a physicist and author of 10 books on science. His latest book is a memoir entitled Building the H-Bomb, A Personal Story, a book that the government has some problems with, something we've been discussing. Ken Ford, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. And if you're a regular listener to the pod, please know we value your thoughts as much as all the others. We'd love a review on iTunes, good or bad. We're in the business to attract more people just like you. So please share what you know. Despite all of the impressive jetliner contrails you can see on a clear day from commercial aircraft at 20 to 40,000 feet, the sky is largely a wasteland. Between 200 feet and 500 feet, it's a desert, folks, a tumbleweed zone of dragonflies, just waiting for fleets of robot drones to start delivering packages to customers' doorsteps in as little as 30 minutes. Amazon, of course, wants to become the stork of package freight delivery, dropping lightweight goods on your doorsteps, bypassing UPS and FedEx, and it turns out the FAA as well. The Federal Aviation Administration has so frustrated Amazon with its slow pace of regulations and approvals that Amazon has packed up and gone to Canada for its testing. And The Guardian's Ed Pilkington got an exclusive invitation to visit the unnamed Amazon Canadian test site. Ed Pilkington is chief reporter for The Guardian in the U.S. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Ed.
Hi.
So how much of a brave new world is this for the FAA, these unmanned drones and this whole new class of civilian aircraft?
In the world of drones, things are happening at exceptional lightning speed. The people involved in this technology liken it to the first 10 years in the history of aviation at the beginning of the 20th century. And therefore, they're not prepared to sit back and wait for the FAA to wake up to this new technology. And it's causing a great tension between businesses and scientists and aeronautics engineers and the regulators, the FAA.
What ideas do the regulators have, and for that matter, do the technologists have about controlling the airspace and maintaining control between drones and keeping the unmanned aircraft from colliding with the civilian manned aircraft?
Well, if you talk to the Amazon's team of pretty impressive, experienced people, including a former NASA astronaut, as I did when I was in Canada last week, they will tell you that most of the problem doesn't exist because there is this strip of airspace between about 200 feet, which is where most buildings end, and about 500 feet, which is where general aviation space begins. And in this slice of 300 feet of air, there's virtually nothing. So they're saying most of the problem doesn't exist. And they're also saying that technology is developing incredibly quickly. And it's true that NASA has already just jumped in and is saying it is developing an air traffic control system for drones. So once NASA gets involved, you can imagine things will again move even faster.
And delivering goods and devices to the tops of buildings, to, I suppose, humanitarian needs, all these kinds of things.
It's becoming clear that if you can open up this slice of 300 feet of airspace, you can start to imagine incredible things happening. Now, Amazon is the sort of most commercial outside of that. They say they want to deliver their packages within 30 minutes of me going online and ordering something. They say 86% of all their goods that they sell are under 5 pounds in weight and that they can carry those goods through a drone. I think there are lots of uses that we haven't yet begun to really get our heads around, whether it's search and rescue, whether it's law enforcement, raising issues of privacy. I think there are lots more privacy issues down the line.
And you've seen this in action.
Yes, I mean, I can't claim it was incredibly futuristic what I saw. Amazon is testing individual functions. So the day I went, they were testing how you could interface a drone that can fly directly into the air and then sideways. I mean, that was kind of impressive, but they're not yet showing the world what they promise will be incredible new birds. We're not seeing them yet.
Did you ask them, when will I receive my first Amazon gadget, device, book, whatever, by drone?
They're confident that it's going to happen in the next few years. That's why they've said to the FAA, we're not going to stick around. The FAA has produced a new rule book, which will take 2 years to come online. And even then, it doesn't really offer them what they want. So they've said, bye-bye, we're off to Canada, we can't stick around.
Ed Pilkington, chief reporter for The Guardian in the U.S. Thanks so much, Ed.
Thanks.
And to check out a video of what Amazon's drone delivery actually looks like, visit us at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Here is Maria Altman, shortly before her death, speaking to George Clooney's crew for the movie Monuments Men about the quest to recover paintings stolen by the Nazis.
The picture does have a story of its own to tell. Now it travels to another country to be seen by other people, more people, and that's very beautiful for me.
Maria Altman won her case, and her story became the basis for the new feature film, Woman in Gold. Among the thousands of stolen paintings and other valuable art belonging to Jews was a Gustav Klimt painting entitled Portrait of Adele Bloch Bauer I. After World War II, the painting ended up in the Austrian State Gallery, which claimed ownership of it. And half a century after that, Adele's niece, Maria Altman, fought to get the painting back. In Woman in Gold, Maria Altman is played by actress Helen Mirren.
My uncle commissioned Gustav Klimt to paint her.
That's quite a painting.
It's magnificent. She was taken off the walls of our home by the Nazis. And since then, she's been hanging in the Belvedere Gallery in Vienna.
And now you'd like to be reunited.
I have to do what I can to keep these memories alive.
Woman in Gold is in theaters this Friday. Director Simon Curtis and the real Randy Schoenberg, Altman's determined lawyer and lifelong friend, says the film is all about memory as the most important weapon fighting the forces that would dare to destroy a people.
Well, Maria Altman was my grandmother's closest friend. My grandmother had passed away about 10 years earlier, but my mom kept up with her, and she called me and asked me to help her out in trying to recover these paintings that had belonged to her uncle and were taken by the Nazis. So that's how it started, and I went on this long 8-year journey with her. And it really was a journey of discovering about her family and about my family background. So it was an amazing journey.
Now, certainly to do something that would redress the abuses of the Nazis has all kinds of moral weight behind it. But the practicality?
Yeah. I mean, so obviously when you're dealing with historical events and these terrible historical events of World War II, it's difficult and you have to really get your mind frame into that. But then the practical part of it, of how do you recover something at this late stage, 60, 70 years later, it becomes quite difficult. And we were lucky that Austria, actually to Austria's credit, had passed a law in 1998 that allowed the government to return artworks that had been taken and not properly returned. And that's the law that we used, but it took a while.
Did Maria always believe this was possible, that this justice could be served?
Both of us thought that it should happen. Whether it would happen was the real question mark. And, you know, I think we had this hope that if we could get in the right position, in the right forum, then justice would prevail. But it was not obvious.
Well, that's certainly where you get involved, Simon.
Yeah, I was very struck that the story was in somehow one of the great stories of the 20th century, because it linked Vienna in its heyday at the beginning of the 20th century, when it was really the crucible for many of the greatest ideas of the whole century. And through a sort of awful chain of events, Maria and the painting both ended the century in the United States.
And how do you see the paintings as emblematic of the echoes of World War II and Nazism that live with us today?
In the case of these paintings, or the famous woman in gold, it's easy to forget that Maria Helene's character, Maria's uncle, commissioned Gustav Klimt to paint her aunt, and then that painting was on the wall of the family home. It was a family that was at the very heart of the Jewish community in Vienna that was literally destroyed overnight.
What was it like to see her come alive in the character of Helen Mirren?
For me, it's terrific. Maria passed away in 2011, so a few years ago, and to see her sort of live on in this film is an amazing thing. You know, we always said, even if nothing comes out of it, even if we lose in the Supreme Court, it's telling the story that was so important to us. And Simon really has made this whole film about memory.
A film about memory?
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, I mean, most of the film is set in contemporary California and Vienna, or near contemporary. And it's the journey of this odd couple, if you like. It's Ryan Reynolds playing Randy and Helen Mirren playing Maria. And they go on this voyage of discovery. But we felt it was important that punctuating that was Maria remembering various telling moments in her past. And there's a sort of feeling that she had suppressed these memories and hadn't thought about them for the longest time. But during the course of our journey, we see her remembering her aunt talking to her about the painting or her famous wedding day, which was the last big social Jewish event in Vienna before the Nazis arrived.
How are the paintings characters in this film?
Well, there were five paintings, three landscapes and two portraits of Adele, but we've really focused on the woman in gold. I mean, that's the most famous one, and somehow very specifically about Maria's aunt. And we had to work really hard. In fact, I was quite blasé about the recreating, because they weren't going to FedEx the original to us, to our shoot. So we had to recreate both the work in progress and the finished product. And you know, it took Klimt 3 years, I think, to make the so it was a very skillful job. But we have a lot of close-ups of the portrait, and we start the film with seeing the gold leaf being put onto the painting. And as Maria says in the film, the postcards don't do her justice. The you have to go and see the painting, which is here in New York on permanent display at the Neue Gallery, because nothing about its reproductions prepares you for its magnificence in person.
And of course, it's magnificent as art, but because it was on the wall in the family home, and people grew up with it and had a relationship with it, Is there a sense of the reuniting of the painting in the film?
One of my favorite lines in the film is, your aunt's round the corner at the Belvedere. Are you ready for the reunion? And there is a sense of her seeing her aunt for the first time in 50, 60 years. So that's one of my favorite moments in the film. And Helen plays it brilliantly, I think.
One of my favorite moments of the case, not in the film, but we brought all five paintings back to the L.A. County Museum of Art when they left Vienna. And there was Maria with her extended family, her children and grandchildren, surrounded by these five paintings in one room, which was just how they had been when she had last seen them in Vienna.
Wow.
So that was really the greatest moment for me.
And you were there.
Yeah, I was
there.
Did
the paintings recognize them? Is there a kind of a, you know, art is magical. It is absolutely magical.
Yeah, well, Maria's aunt was her mother's sister who was married to her father's brother, right? So there's... She's a blood relative, and you can see the look in the whole family. There's a resemblance.
And I think that's just a bittersweet journey of the film because, I mean, I think people know how the film ends, but in some ways that there's a hope in Maria that she will bring back her family, it will bring back her father, and of course it can't.
But it's also about what lives in the face of unimaginable death.
It's one of the few things that we can do. Still, 60, 70 years later, is give people back some possessions to rectify some of the wrongs of World War II.
Well, the film is Women in Gold, and it's directed by Simon Curtis here in the studio, along with Randy Schoenberg, who helped the real Maria Altman fight to reclaim the Gustav Klimt painting and other paintings that are a part of the story of Women in Gold. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today.
Break one. This is the bandit. It's a snowman out there. Am I hitting you, son?
Mercy sakes. You put about 8.5 on me. Blowing the windows down. Bring it on.
Hey, good buddy. Who were the original bloggers and texters? That's easy. It's a 10-4. It was the CB radio ladies and dudes on Citizen Band Radio from the 70s and 80s. CB is back, folks, complete with Smokies and 18-wheelers pushing the late-night routes from Wheeling, West Virginia to Newport News or Tacoma to Terre Haute. The FCC said this week the designated wireless spectrum will be called Citizens Broadband Radio Service. No license required. Thanks so much for listening. 10-4, I'm out. John Hockenberry, this is The Takeaway.
It was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling logs. Cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs. We is heading for Bear on I-10.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation. For increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.